All right, today, as we continue in our series, A Better Hope, we've got a further unfolding of what Tim began to unwrap for us last week as we looked at the first two-thirds of Hebrews chapter 11 and what is called the Hall of Faith by many people. You know, all of the examples of the lives that are lived and told about in chapter 11 are meant to point us to a reality. To the reality that if we have this particular quality, we will be able to handle anything. And I can mean that with some qualifications, or I can get specific, but we could handle anything if we have this quality. And it doesn't mean that you're going to be exempt from hard things if you have this quality. It means that if you have it, no matter what happens to you, those things will not destroy you. The quality which the author of Hebrews has been pointing us to is faith. And we've heard over the course of many weeks what faith is. We've seen how it is a foundation, how it speaks, how it hopes, how faith does not make itself at home here, how faith is rewarded, how it's grounded in history and in a person, how without it you cannot please God. Today the author wants to further refine our understanding of faith. And as we look at Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 40, we're going to be looking at the surprising turn, the unexpected answer, and the life of faith. Lucas Galbier is going to come forward, and he's going to read our passage. I hope. There he is, yes.
Our sermon text this morning is from Hebrews 11, 32 to 40. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release, so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mocking and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains, in dens and caves of the earth. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. This is the word of the Lord.
Okay, so firstly, let's look at the surprising turn. And that happens in this passage. You know, there's a kind of a movie that's out there where you come to the end of the movie and there's this surprising turn in perspective and everything is turned over. M. Night Shyamalan. Did I get it? Close. Thanks. He's a director, right? If you're familiar with his movie, he's a director whose movies that we expect just that kind of turn. At the end of his movies, we realize that we've been watching it from a perspective that is backwards or upside down. You know, you're watching the movie and you think that the movie is about this thing, and then you come to realize that it's about something else. Completely different. And then when you watch the movie a second time, you see that all the clues were there for you to understand the movie in which it was told, but you ignored those clues because you were committed to what you thought the movie was about. You were willfully ignoring those clues because you were committed to your agenda. Now, everybody has a belief system. Everyone believes that their story is playing out this kind of certain way, and consequently that the end of the story of your life, the movie of your life, right, there's going to be blessing, and everyone is looking to live their life in such a way so that they might come to the end of their own movie, right, and enjoy blessing. And they look to many different things for that blessing, right? They look to, these things that provide meaning and purpose, like imagine success or prosperity. Religion is a way in which people try and live that out. Comfort is a way in which people imagine life is going to be good. Achievement, what they accomplish, if they have happy kids, if they have a happy wife, if they have a happy husband, if their teacher is happy, if their parents are happy, whether their neighbors are jealous of them or not, whether they've had social connection, all of these things people are looking to in their life to try and understand the meaning and purpose of their life and what's going to end up with blessing. Now, the first half of these verses, you know, this section that we're looking at today, reflects what we readily expect is going to be the outcome of living by faith. Let's look there. Verses 33 and 35, or the first half of 35. Those who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, sorry about that, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of the fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong in weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women receive back their dead by resurrection. Conquering, enforcing, obtaining, stopping, quenching, and receiving back are just the sorts of words that we like to read about. The surprising turn comes with the others. Continuing in verse 35, we read, some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others suffered mockings and floggings and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, whom the world was not worthy. Wandering about in deserts and mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. Tortured, suffered mockings and floggings, sawn in two by faith. Think about that. Right. If you notice in the passage, there's kind of a sentence break, but there's a transition. The transition comes as the author is talking about some significant women in the Old Testament. Women of faith. And in verse 35, we read that the women received back their dead by resurrection. Now, this is referring to two Old Testament women in the book of 1 and 2 Kings. The first is the widow of Zarephath, who the Lord, through the prophet Elijah, raised her son who had died from the dead. And the second is the Shunammite's son in 2 Kings, who the Lord, through the prophet Elisha, raised from the dead. Now, you might think that the third woman, would enjoy the same blessing. That's not true. She is among the others. The third woman of whom this author refers is the mother of a story who was told in the book of Maccabees, right? And by this, this transition, some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. That sentence there is speaking about that third woman and her sons. If you go to the book of Maccabees, which is written about the events that took place between Alexander the Great conquering the Palestine region and his descendants to whom he handed over his empire, or who took his empire, the Ptolemies, right, of whom Cleopatra is a descendant, and the Seleucids, right, who were in Damascus. The Seleucids were ruling in this area at this time, after Alexander the Great. And there was a king named Antiochus Epiphanes. And the story of the book of Maccabees is about how Israel got out, who defeated the Seleucids and set up their own independence again. That victory, driving the Seleucids out of Jerusalem, is the event that is celebrated in the Feast of the Dedication, or Hanukkah, right? The Festival of Lights. One of the things that's being recognized is that Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of the Seleucids, was defeated. Now, one of the things that Antiochus Epiphanes did, was known to do, was that he defiled the temple in Jerusalem. And the way he did that was to sacrifice a pig on the altar there. Can anyone say the abomination that causes desolation? In addition to that, right, all of what Antiochus Epiphanes did is that he demanded that the Jews themselves defile themselves by eating pork. Now, during the height of that persecution, one mother was forced, and you can read about this in 2 Maccabees 7, one mother was forced to watch her 7 sons be tortured and then martyred as they each refused to eat what was being offered to them. And we read in 2 Maccabees 7, her words, the writer says, the mother, was especially admirable and worthy of honorable memory. She's remembered here. Though she saw her 7 sons perish within a single day, she bore it with good courage because of her hope in the Lord. She encouraged each of them in the language of their fathers. Filled with a noble spirit, she fired her woman's reasoning with a man's courage. There's a lot there. She fired her woman's reasoning with a man's courage and said to them, I do not know how you came into being in my womb. It was not I who gave you life and breath, nor I who set in order the elements within each of you. Therefore, the creator of the world who shaped the beginning of man and devised the origin of all things will in his mercy give life and breath back to you again, since you now forget yourselves for the sake of his laws. She was not spared the death of her 7 sons. But do you see how she hoped in the resurrection in the midst of it? Right, the others here in this passage force us to conclude that living by faith does not mean that your circumstances will miraculously change for the better. Blessing comes, but that's not a guarantee. Nor does living by faith mean that you will not suffer, possibly greatly. What living by faith does mean is that even in the midst of the most confounding, trying, terrible circumstances, you can be confident that you have been set upon a firm foundation of ultimate salvation by the Lord, and that contrary to the dictates of your circumstances, you may experience surprising intrusions of peace and courage and love in spite of your circumstances. Friends, to witness that kind of faith in the midst of those sorts of circumstances is the most remarkable thing. And I want you to know that I have seen that in your lives as you have chosen to believe. It's a great privilege and an honor. Right? The introduction of the others brings with it a challenge to ask for, you know, to ask each one of us, if we're reading the story of our lives and our circumstances rightly, right? How is it that we're reading our lives? And what do we think our circumstances speak to the purpose and end of our lives and its fulfillment? And whether or not we're just reading our stories upside down from the way in which the Lord is telling it. And this points us to an unexpected answer. We expect that living by faith will lead to success and triumph in this life, but that is not what the author is saying. If you look at the passage, you'll see that faith doesn't mean the assurance of comfort. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. It's not the assurance of comfort and ease in this life. In fact, the reality that faith does not mean comfort and ease in this life actually was always present in the passage. Even in the passages just before this second section here in Hebrews 11, those passages that we read in Victories. Consider the examples prior to the mother in Maccabees. If you look at verse 34, the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it's a great victory in our mind, right? This is one of those stories that we all know about. We were taught in Sunday school. We continue to remember. Can you remember what they did? What does he say here? He says that they quenched the fury of the flames. But did they quench the fury of the flames? No, the Lord did. It was actually the fourth one who appeared in the furnace with them who preserved them through the fire. You know, living by faith does not mean that things must work as you imagine that they must work. When King Nebuchadnezzar actually prepares to throw them in the fiery furnace, we read in Daniel chapter 3, verse 16 and after, that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." Now, that sounds just as we would expect, but what follows is almost more important. They answered, "But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." But if not what? If our God whom we serve does not deliver us from the fiery furnace. Right? This reveals a component of faith which we don't often speak about. It's what C.S. Lewis calls the obstinacy in belief. There's an anchor for you. Hold on to that. The obstinacy in belief. He gives a wonderful depiction of it, of obstinacy in belief in one of the Chronicles of Narnia, one that we read this past summer. Several weeks ago, I actually referred to the silver chair, a scene in the silver chair. And in that illustration, I was reminding you that the enchantment of the world is to be disenchanted to the glory of God, right? That the enchantment that we are all in danger of succumbing to is to believe that this world is all that there is, and all that happens in this world is all that matters. The silver chair, right? In the silver chair, this witch is trying to enchant the children with an enchantment of disenchantment, right? That they're in the underworld. They're down deep down in a cave underground, and she's trying to convince them that there was real no Narnia. There was no upper world, no real world up above. And she strums a harp, and she burns a magic intoxicating incense, and she tells them, you know, there was no other world, right? There is no world except this world. Now, going further into the scene, there's another character who was not introduced in my illustration I said before, and that character's name is Puddleglum. Can I have that picture of Puddleglum? If it's there. So puddle glum is a marsh wiggle. And as a marsh wiggle, he's kind of a blend between kind of a humanoid frog. He's got webbed feet like a duck. And in that scene, he's actually the older companion. He is their guide. And one of the things that he does is that he goes and he steps on the fire in which the enchantress has put this incense, this magic incense. And so he stomps the fire out with his webbed foot. Puddleglum, who is a battle-hardened veteran of past wars, he knows that what will clear his head is something that you wouldn't naturally look to, and that is pain. Pain clears the head. He steps on the enchantress's fire because, like I said, as a marsh wickle, he has webbed feet like a duck, not like ours. And we read that the smell of the enchantress's fire grew much less because the smell of burnt marsh wiggle is not very enchanting. This made everyone's brains far clearer, we read. And Puddleglum, who's had trouble proving to the witch, right, arguing with her, debating with her about the reality of the upper world, disproving what it is that she has to say about what is true, she's basically telling them that it's just a wish fulfillment dream, that you're just taking the things in this world and kind of making them bigger, true things, right? The way in which this happens oftentimes in some psychiatric Freudianism, basically, is that your desire for a God is really because you're just disappointed in your father and you want a better father. And so you imagine a better father who is God. And that's all, it's just a wish fulfillment dream. Now, the problem with that is that if that's all that God is, then it's also true that your belief that there isn't a God is really just a wish fulfillment dream. Do you understand? I mean, you can't, God either is or he isn't. What you think about it doesn't necessarily matter. But she's basically trying to push this idea on him that Narnia is just a wish fulfillment dream. Aslan is just a bigger cat. And this is what he has to say. "One word, ma'am," he said, coming back from the fire, limping because of the pain. "One word. All you've been saying is quite right, I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who likes to know the worst and then put the best face on it he can. So I won't deny that any of what you've said. But there's one more thing that needs to be said even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We're just babies, as you say, making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So thanking you kindly for your supper, if these two gentlemen and this young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say. Obstinacy in faith." Now, faith is not, as Tim told us last week and reminded us, unreasonable. Faith sometimes is obstinate in its trust in the promises of God. The faith that is obstinate is not a faith that chooses to believe untrue things. Being obstinate in faith is like asking your child to trust you as you work to remove a splinter from their hand. by all the data, by all appearances, and certainly by every sensation, the treatment to remove the splinter seems worse than the cure, right? Than actually having the splinter, that's what I meant to say. The treatment of removing the splinter seems hugely worse than just leaving the splinter where it is. Yet you ask the child to believe in you in spite of their present experience, not because of an experiment or equation that's verified the validity of the existence of the parent, but because you, as their parent, dearly love them. That's living by faith. That's trusting, right? This is this new way of living, to the life of faith. You know, how do you do that? How do you live by faith? The author gives us a couple of answers. He tells us to live as an alien. Going back, right, into Tim's message from last week, you wait in hope in the home that he has prepared for you. By faith, Abraham lived as an alien in a land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promises, for he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. We are to live in this world being what the Bible calls resident aliens. That is, to live at home as a stranger, looking for a city that has foundations. Right? When we turn from living by faith, when we say, I don't want to wait anymore, we choose to make ourselves at home in this world. And as a consequence, we shun weakness and vulnerability, and trust. And we use and turn to power in order to control and overpower and to make the thing happen that we want to happen. Right? Those kinds of behaviors flow out of a belief that we are entitled to what it is that we want now and that our circumstances should be trouble-free. That's not living by faith. So, firstly, you live by faith by living as a resident alien. Secondly, you live by faith, you worship the one who is sovereign. Now, one of my favorite all-time images is described in verse 21 of Hebrews chapter 11. It points back to Genesis 50, where the author of Hebrews writes, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons as he worshiped and leaned on the top of his staff. Now, can you see that? Joseph, the son whom he thought had died, is standing before him alive, the son of his favorite wife. Not only that, but Joseph has two sons. Joseph is looking back there, kind of over them, to the events of his life, all the events that led him to deceive his own father. Right? The events that brought about his own children's deception as they sold Joseph into slavery and brought back the coat of many colors and said, you know, a lion has eaten your son. He's dead. He's gone to you forever, from you forever. He remembered the event in which he wrestled the angel of the Lord as he was coming back into the promised land. And it was and of course, as he is leaning on his staff, that's the very reason, because his hip had been dislocated and he walked with a limp the rest of his life. Jacob is a picture of one who's internalized what Joseph is later going to say in the book of Hebrews to his brothers, when after Jacob dies, the brothers are now convinced that, you know, all bets are off and any kindness that they've enjoyed from Jacob is over because now, or from Joseph is over because now he's free to kill them and give them, pay them back for what it is that they did to him. But do you remember what Joseph told them? In Genesis 50, 20, you intended to harm me. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. Right? Those who live by faith trust in the Lord, and the fruit of that faith is, as we see in Jacob's life, worship. Not worship and you doing and being forced to do something that you're not inclined to do or you don't want to do, but worship that is the overflow of the beauty and majesty and glory of what it is that God has accomplished, rejoicing in what it is that he's accomplished. That's our inheritance. That's our promise. From that vantage point, from the vantage point of the end, for those who have placed their trust in the Lord and lived by faith, the received blessing, the blessing that will come to you and I, to us, will be worth more than all of the losses we've given. It can't be anything less than that. Thirdly, right, you seek the one who is beautiful. We see in verse 23 that by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw that he was no ordinary child. They weren't afraid of the king's edict. The way in which Genesis describes Moses' appearance is that he was tob, right? He was beautiful. He was different. They saw that he was no ordinary child. They saw something more. And the author of Hebrews, he goes on to say that Moses regarded himself disgrace on account of Christ of greater value than all the treasures of Egypt. That's why he left. This is just what the author of Hebrews is going to come to say in Hebrews chapter 12 when he speaks of Jesus, who for the joy set before him endured the cross and scorned its shame. That Jesus regarded his disgrace well worth the joy that was set before him. And what was the joy that was set before him? It was the beauty of you and I with him. And we will be with him if we only entrust ourselves to him, entrust our lives to him. Lastly, by living by faith is that you live in hope. Living in hope means that sometimes you are obstinate in your belief. It's the demonstration of faith, not only of the woman who received back from the dead her children, or the two women who received back from the dead their children, but even the faith of the woman who did not, who saw her seven sons killed. Right? It's the kind of faith which Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego demonstrate in even if. It was what Job actually proclaims. It's that's the sentiment behind Job saying, yet though he slay me, I will trust in him. Right? Faith in the Lord is of such inestimable value. You can have confidence no matter what it is that you face. Right? This faith is a gift, and it's found in the face of a person, in Jesus Christ, our great high priest. To be filled with the vision of who Jesus is and what it is that he's done for us, right? It's worth it all.